This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films, The Mummy, It Comes at Night, My Cousin Rachel, Megan Levy, and it's a couple weeks old, but I still want to talk about War Machine. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and the home cinema roundup featuring Beauty and the Beast and Bambi. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
I'm actually going to skip a little bit of the news this week because I want to talk about a bigger story that dovetails in with the success of last week with Wonder Woman, which exceeded all expectations of everybody who were, well, maybe not the people who were going so extreme that were predicting on a $115 million weekend, but most people, especially the studio, they were predicting $75 million at the top, and it made over $100 million, which is great. You know, I mean, I don't want to take any success away from anybody. I'll talk a little bit more about the actual box office and the numbers and what that means. But this is in response not to the movie, because, and I want to make this abundantly clear, I am not at all criticizing the movie or Patty Jenkins or even Warner Brothers in this at all. I am still kind of against my own industry, which is entertainment news, and how they have handled themselves, not just a couple weeks ago with the Pirates of the Caribbean, but with Wonder Woman itself. Just last week, I do want to go on record and point out that last week I dissed Gal Gadot a bit with her acting, and that's because she's not the strongest actress, but I give her credit on this in a big, big way. She got the message that she wasn't a great actor. I mean, if you go back to the Fast and Furious movies and even stuff like Criminal or Keeping Up with the Joneses, which are much more recent films that she's been in, where she's been given a little bit more meat than just a pretty sidekick to Han in the Fast and Furious movies. You know, she's never been that good, but she really took this seriously, and she honed her craft. And I had somebody say to me over last week, they said, remember when they were talking about doing a Wonder Woman movie with Megan Fox? And reality finally set in for me on this, and I realized one of the reasons that actually Gal Gadot was a good choice for this, she's not like a big movie star. She's not an actor who has been on all these covers of magazines for other movies. Megan Fox was. Megan Fox would not have taken this seriously. Megan Fox wouldn't have taken a lick of acting classes. She would have just showed up and puked out her lines and gave her smell the fart acting sneer. She is a bad actress who doesn't do anything with any sort of substance whatsoever. Gal Gadot did. And that's why Gal Gadot was far superior of a choice than Megan Fox, because even though they're not great actors, either of them are, Gal Gadot is going through the worst. She didn't just physically try and work on her physicality and bulk up a bit. She tried to work on her acting ability, and it's not perfect, but it's a great first step. And who knows, get a couple more movies deep into this franchise, and you might have some serious acting to contend with. So, you know, kudos to, you know, Gal Gadot deserves a lot for this, because she really did make the role her own. Now, with all that said, there was a narrative that was being spun, and it was being spun very specifically back over Memorial Day weekend with Pirates of the Caribbean and Baywatch. Do good reviews make a movie successful? And conversely, do bad reviews contribute to the non-success of a movie? And I contend that there's a symbiotic relationship there, but it's far more complex than that. Now, I was actually having arguments with people on Twitter about this, and they're like, oh, well, you don't think the good reviews told people that they should go see it? I go, no, because for every Wonder Woman, I can show you probably five movies that got terrible reviews that still did well. I mean, great example is the Transformers movie, and particularly like Transformers 2, those kind of movies that got bad reviews and still broke box office records. And even to this very specific one-to-one comparison, let's compare Wonder Woman to Suicide Squad. Wonder Woman had great reviews. Suicide Squad had garbage reviews. Suicide Squad not only made more in its opening weekend, but it'll probably make more in its full run. So you cannot sit there and tell me that good reviews are what's actually driving people to movies. I think that they can in certain respects, and it certainly doesn't hurt the marketing of the film. But that's ultimately what reviewers and the entertainment press is. It's an element of the marketing machine. And if you know how to handle it, it works. Because I can also line up a whole slew of movies that had fantastic reviews. I could find you dozens of movies in just the last year that have 90% or more on Rotten Tomatoes, and nobody went and saw it. A great example, this is a couple of years ago, but the Scott Pilgrim movie back in, 2011? That movie had some of the best reviews around, and it was, comic book movie and everything. That thing flopped. It flopped so hard. It bombed. Epically bombed. The reality is, it's word of mouth that drives it. It's whether or not the movie looks good and is good sometimes helps it out, or if it just connects to an audience. You know, something like the Transformers movies certainly connect to an audience. They're garbage, but they connect to an audience. Same thing Twilight. You can't tell me that bad reviews will tank a movie when Twilight, they made, five movies and it was a $1 billion franchise. You don't want reviews to be like theater reviews. Whereas bad theater reviews in on Broadway will kill a show. You don't want to have that power because you want to be able to like a movie or not like a movie and not have to worry about the impacting people's salaries and lives. And you also don't want the studios to think, if bad reviews are going to tank this, we're just not going to show it. And what will end up happening, the end result of that will be you will only see the movies that they're confident are going to get great reviews. And anything that might have questionable reviews, they're going to keep from you. And then they're going to screen 10 movies a year and that's it. And for lazy reviewers out there, that's fine. But for somebody like me, that's a terrible idea. So let's pump the brakes on that narrative. Just let the reviews be. And reviews may or may not drive box office, but what they do is they serve an essential purpose for marketing and creating buzz and generating buzz and bringing the narrative and talking about the film. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit is American Made, directed by Doug Liman, starring Tom Cruise. It opens on September 29th.
Top of your class in the Civil Air Patrol? A pilot like you shouldn't be flying buses. You should be serving your country.
Your CIA.
Shh. We need you to deliver stuff for us.
Oh, this is legal? If you're doing it for the good guys.
You are an airline pilot, Barry. That's how you support this family.
This is going to be good for us.
Legal?
You trust me?
No.
This is sort of like that true story of a smuggler who's working for the CIA. I can't shake the fact that it just feels like another rehash of something like War Dogs or The Infiltrator. Wasn't that one with Bryan Cranston last year? We've seen these movies before and they kind of are never big hits because they never have a great narrative story through the end. So maybe this will be different. I don't know. Doug Liman has produced some good stuff and Tom Cruise with him actually did Edge of Tomorrow, which is great, but there's no aliens or time travel in this movie. The next one I want to talk about is Murder on the Orient Express, which opens on November 10th.
So they got him after all. Indeed, he was murdered.
Good God, murder here?
If there was a murder.
What is going on?
Then there was a murderer. The murderer is with us.
And every one of you is a suspect.
And who are you?
My name is Hercule Poirot.
Now, this is one of the higher profile Agatha Christie books that have been turned into movies. This has been done at least twice before. They had Albert Finney. Actually, Albert Finney got nominated for an Oscar for his portrayal of Hercule Poirot. But I always grew up with Peter Ustinov as Hercule Poirot. And he totally didn't do him the way he was in the book, but it was fun to watch him. So this looks like we're going to get an authentic Poirot performance, even though we've seen it on TV. But it looks like this is a great story. And I think this is something that Kenneth Branagh can do because he's actually really good. He's actually amazingly good with that intimate stuff. The broad, expansive movies like Jack Ryan or Thor maybe aren't his best things. His better stuff is kind of these smaller, intimate movies. So I'm kind of looking forward to this one. That is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about It Comes at Night and My Cousin Rachel. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's roll into the movie reviews. We got a bunch of them to talk about. The first one is It Comes at Night. It's a intimate horror film, or a marginally horror film. We'll talk about that in a second. It's directed by Trey Edward Schultz, who directed Krisha last year. A family is quietly surviving in a secluded house in the woods after an apocalyptic plague when a new family shows up to become friends, but also possibly pose a threat.
I'm going to try and help your new family.
I want to thank you guys for letting us stay here.
Just going to run through a few things. When we go out during the day, we like to stick to groups just for safety. The red door. It's the only way in and out of the house. It stays closed and locked. We never go out at night.
The door was already open when you got there.
Yeah.
Then who opened it?
I associated this a little bit more with the people who did movies like It Follows or Your Next or some of these more independent, smaller horror films that has, sort of like that VHS crowd that worked on them. This, I didn't realize, was directed by the guy who did Krisha. And after finding that out and looking back at this movie, I said, oh, this totally makes sense, because Krisha is kind of cut from the same cloth. I know not a lot of people saw it. It was a smaller movie last year. I think it was like John Waters' favorite movie or something like that. And that kind of gave it a little bit of notoriety at the end of the year. But the thing with Krisha is that was directed like a horror movie, but essentially was just a family interpersonal angst drama. There was nothing horrific about Krisha, but it basically took a kitchen sink drama and framed it in the way you would make a horror movie. And essentially what this film is, It Comes at Night, I wouldn't even call it a horror movie. And that's a little disappointing to me, because the marketing, the posters and the trailers made it really feel like there was something, you know, almost supernaturally horrific out in the woods. And is it a spoiler to say? Because you find out pretty early that it's this plague that they're trying to avoid. And in a way, he's trying to go the way, Eli Roth did with Cabin Fever back, 15 years ago. When Eli Roth made Cabin Fever, he was essentially saying, I'm going to do a Cabin in the Woods horror movie where the monster is a disease, a communicable disease, and it was flesh-eating bacteria. And that really worked. Essentially, it was a slasher movie, only there was nobody in a hockey mask with a machete. It was this bacteria that could infect you and then, destroy you. And I thought that was arguably Eli Roth's best movie, but it was also a kind of an interesting experiment cinematically. And that's what Schultz is doing in this movie, in that he's trying to make it framed like a horror movie, but it really isn't. And while there's horror elements to it, certainly, and I think you can categorize it that way, you're kind of making a stretch. And especially if you look at the marketing, it really plays its hand heavily that you're waiting for a monster to jump out, essentially, kind of thing. But that's not what the movie is. And I think that's going to be its downfall, because I think true horror fans are going to be let down by it. I was let down by it. I wanted something a little bit more. It'd be like if when they made It Follows, a year or two ago, if It Follows would have then been just a disease and not really this entity that was this bizarre, almost ghost-like entity that followed you around, and if it was all in your head. And I've never been a big fan of that sort of Scooby-Doo approach to it, where they're like, oh, it could be something really cool. No, it's not. It's just humanity in there. And that was my biggest problem with It Comes at Night. I mean, it's well made. It's, I like the fact, and this is one of those movies nowadays, these independent smaller horror movies that are not just refusing to use like found footage, but going in the opposite direction completely, where what they're trying to do is, you know, do very atmospheric, very slow movement, camera, locked down or on a very slow dolly, and using soundtrack and ambient noise to really build the tension. I love that in those movies. And in that sense, I think this is very well done. And the characters are really good. It's got good acting in it. I just wanted more. I wanted there to be something more to it than just what we got. And so on that respect, I mean, I guess I'm going to say it kind of rocks. I mean, it's worth seeing just because it's an interesting movie, but you got to know that going in. Don't expect something because you won't get it.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I want to talk about is My Cousin Rachel. In the 1800s, a man's surrogate father marries a woman while abroad for health reasons, then mysteriously dies. And when this woman comes to his original home, the man finds himself initially suspicious of her and then falling in love.
Whatever it cost my cousin in pain and suffering before he died, I will return in full measure upon the woman that caused it.
You need to read the letter.
You must have hated me.
You're not the woman I hated.
How easy it must be for a woman like Rachel to twist you around her little finger.
You know nothing about her.
Or is it you who know nothing?
I want you to be my wife.
Have you gone out of your mind?
This is based on a book by Daphne Demure, who did The Birds and Rebecca. I believe they did make this into a movie with like Olivia de Havilland many years ago, but this is a modern version. It has Rachel Weisz playing the cousin and has Sam Chaplin, who's from The Hunger Games and that awful movie Me Before You last year. He plays this initial guy who's he's an heir to this estate. And his cousin, who had kind of taken him in after his father died, he was the one who went off and married the Rachel Weisz character. This is essentially gothic romance thriller. And while it has some really it has a really interesting look because it encompasses the natural lighting that took place in that era because, you know, you'd open windows and, you know, light candles. From a cinematography, from an artistic standpoint and the like costume design and everything, it's very well done. I think the acting's pretty good. Rachel Weisz is quite good in the movie. It's funny because I'd recently rewatched The Mummy, the 1999 version. And that was almost 20 years ago. So she certainly is a quality actor and she works well in it. Sam Chaplin's okay in it. It suffers at times from some special effects that are a little bit overly ambitious. And I'm talking about stuff like backgrounds. There's a scene where the characters are in Italy and they're standing on a balcony and the backdrop just looks so false because you can digitally alter or create a backdrop doesn't mean you should. The other problem I had with this is, and this is, I struggle with this when there's a movie based on a book, especially an older book, because it may be filled with cliches or stuff that we've seen a million times before. But of course, when it was written, maybe this wasn't a cliche. But it's pretty easy to guess where this movie's going. There's not a whole lot of mystery underlying the actions of the characters, and you know exactly what somebody's going to do, and you know when they are doing something stupid. It reminded me a bit of the film Far From the Madding Crowd last year. The character does some really stupid things that annoyed me, and you wouldn't have had a story if you didn't have that conflict in there, but it still bothered me because I felt that they were not good character moments, and you get that a lot in this movie, especially as you get farther and farther, and you're like, well, why are you doing that? That's just stupid. You're not making sense even to yourself, and there's like hints of other things happening. That even in the trailer, if you watch the trailer, you know what's happening in there, and I don't know whether they were deliberately playing their hand blatantly or whether they were trying to be subtle but just weren't. So there's some good parts. There's some bad parts. I respected the movie for what it was trying to do, but ultimately it was just okay. I'm going to be nice, very similar to It Comes at Night. I'm going to be nice and give it a kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Mummy and Megan Levy. There
There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kuykendall Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Kevin Carr here with Fat Guys at the Movies. Welcome back, and we are going to continue with what is supposed to be the big movie for the weekend, and that is The Mummy. A treasure hunter stumbles upon an ancient cursed mummy and inadvertently releases her, causing her to take up her old quest to resurrect an evil Egyptian god.
Whatever's in there has been safely hidden for 2,000 years. The hieroglyph said she was named Amenet, chosen to be Egypt's next queen. But her thirst for power led her down a darker path.
Because of your actions, this ancient power has returned. You are alive because you were chosen.
By what?
Evil.
There's a lot of stuff to sort of deconstruct with The Mummy. First of all, I just want to talk a little bit about the original Mummy back in 1932, which is one of my favorite Universal Monster movie films. It's funny because it sort of exists on its own. There were a whole bunch of other movies, The Mummy's Tomb, The Mummy's Ham, The Mummy's Ghost, The Mummy's Tuna Fish Sandwich. I mean, there are so many other movies that they made. They even made Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy. But all of those were essentially, I think it was The Mummy's Hand that was the first quote unquote sequel to The Mummy, which was really more of a remake. And then all the rest of them kind of went from there. And that's where just The Mummy was. The wrapped up mummy walking around, you know, trying to kill you. But there's an authentic uniqueness to the Boris Karloff version where he is basically a mummy that is able to come back to life and is trying to, resurrect his love. It borrows a little bit from Dracula. It feels very trite in a 1920s sort of way because, I mean, you're just barely into the 30s there. So you get the underdeveloped female characters that you get in movies at that time. But it's a bit misogynistic and there's not a whole lot of depth, to the actress's character in the original Mummy. But I liked Boris Karloff and what he did. And I thought it was a unique movie, especially in the framework where we're looking at all these Universal horror movies. And then I went and I rewatched the 1999 version with Rachel Weisz and Brendan Fraser. And I like that movie. I think it's a fun adventure, kind of like spinning off of an Indiana Jones sort of desert adventure, but it was unique enough on its own right. And I thought it was enough like the original Mummy, but you know, giving it an action sequence type of movie was fine. I didn't have a problem with that. I know some people did. And I think some people still have an issue with the fact that they're going action sequence movies rather than authentic horror. So now we find ourselves with this new Mummy starring Tom Cruise. First of all, one of the things they're doing is they're trying to set up what they're calling the Dark Universe. And if you go see the movie, you're going to see the Dark Universe logo, which to your average viewers, they don't care. It just looks like another production company at the beginning of a movie. But this is Universal trying to essentially do its own Marvel thing. They want to have their own franchise, something like the Avengers. And so they're trying to resurrect, no pun intended, the Universal Monsters. They tried to get it started with Dracula Untold, but that really didn't work out. And they're sort of rebooting that. But they've got the Mummy and you've got Henry Jekyll in here played by Russell Crowe. You've got an Invisible Man movie that they're going to start making with Johnny Depp. They're working on a Gilman movie. They want to do a Hunchback of Notre Dame. They want to do a Wolfman movie. And I'm all for that. And even though Wonder Woman was a success, I still do not think that the DC universe itself is completely gelled. There are only three movies in. They got to get a little deeper into this. Marvel, you didn't know it was really clicking until like the sixth movie. But they want to do Marvel superheroes only as monsters. The action is cool. The effects are usually pretty decent. The girl who plays the mummy, she was the girl with the sword legs from Kingsman. She's great as the mummy. I'm a big fan of hers in this movie. I think she does great. The biggest thing that, you know, got in the way though, and I said this to the rep when I left the movie, the screening rep asked, well, what'd you think? Cause they usually ask me that. And I said, well, if there's one thing you could change in this movie, if there's one thing that you could, if there's any one thing that you could do, like sort of like make that wish with a genie and have it change, I said, if you could have just not made it a Tom Cruise movie, it would have been immensely better. Because Tom Cruise is still trying to be the action star he was 25 years ago. And with the exception of the Mission Impossible movies, they've never quite gotten the traction that they've always been hoping they'd be. The Jack Reacher movies have been okay, but again, even then he was horribly miscast. And part of it is he's always going for a younger actor. I mean, in this one, his love interest is Annabelle Wallace, who is gorgeous, but she's like literally young enough to be his daughter. And it's a little creepy. And even in that American Made trailer, he's his wife is like 20 some years younger than him. And yeah, he looks good in his 50s, but he's still in his 50s. And it's just, it adds to a level of creepiness with Tom Cruise. He needs to do older characters. I mean, he works as Ethan Hunt, but I think he's trying to make everything an Ethan Hunt movie, and this doesn't quite work, and this hinges so much on him. It's sort of like what Will Smith was doing with his movies back before he did After Earth, and then that bombed so hard he kind of disappeared for a couple of years. So while there's certain entertaining aspects to this, all the Tom Cruise-iness of the movie gets in the way. His character is supposed to be a little bit wacky and a little bit crazy, and his banter with he's got Jake Johnson as kind of a sidekick, or Annabelle Wallace, who's the love interest, and they have no chemistry at all. I mean, Jake Johnson and Tom Cruise a little bit, but no chemistry with Annabelle Wallace. And you know, she'll then get fired because he's a producer on this movie. And even where it finally ends up going at the very end, it is sort of unbelievable that they thought that this would work. Also, when you have one of these extended universe franchise movies, there's always a film that kind of puts a pause button in the middle of it and has to explain the franchise. You had that with Iron Man 2, with Samuel L. Jackson as Nick Fury explaining Tony Stark all the S.H.I.E.L.D. stuff. You had that with Batman versus Superman, with Wonder Woman trying to steal a picture and then him going in and finding videos of The Flash or whatever. And that always kills the pace of the movie. And Marvel was smart by putting it in Iron Man 2 because it was a sequel and that had the momentum from the first one. If they had put that garbage into Thor or Captain America, those movies would have come to a screeching halt, and you needed the momentum in those films. So they put it in this movie, and oddly enough, I found it the most interesting stuff, because that's when Russell Crowe comes in and he's Henry Jekyll and he's trying to explain all the stuff that they're trying to do, and he's going into his office and you see like fish gills and stuff. You're like, oh, there's Gill Man, and there's all this kind of stuff that's going to attach all these movies. But then you go back to it being a Tom Cruise movie and just being totally about him. It's something, you take something really big and bigger than any one person, and then he makes it all about himself. It's still okay. I'm going to be kind, like so far I've been with the other films. I'm going to say it kind of rocks because I didn't hate it, but I think that it's not going out of the gate like a great movie.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next movie I want to talk about real quickly is Megan Levy. A woman bonds with an aggressive dog in military service and tries to rescue him when she comes home.
Vehicle approaching.
Guns up.
Why'd you join?
To get away from my life.
We're shipping out tomorrow. We are so not ready for this.
Clear. Levy, check the vehicle.
Where's my dog? I need to see him.
Oh, no. He's just changed his classification so that I can adopt him when he gets back.
They aren't pets. They're warriors.
Now, this one wasn't screened, so the heck with you, Bleecker Street. Learn to screen your movies, and maybe I'll review them at some point. But this looks like it takes all of the good stuff and bad stuff with a boy and his dog movie. I use that in a loose term because it's obviously Kate Mara as Megan Levy. It takes all the good and bad of those and mix it with all the good and bad of military movies where you're trying to tell a hero story. There's a lot of pitfalls in that because it can get overly cheesy and overly corny, or trying to be overly dour and trying to show all the problems. There's a lot of pitfalls in both those. And same thing with a dog rescue kind of movie. You sometimes with the dog movie, like, and I said this with The Dog's Purpose. I said this with Max. I didn't care about the human characters. I cared more about the dog. I think this movie would be more appealing to me if it was called Rex, which is the dog's name, than Megan Levy, because I'm watching the trailer and I'm thinking, oh, all I'm going to get is all the angst of, you know, sort of like a social misfit who joins the Marines. and she has fights with her family, and it's her struggling to come home and dealing with PTSD, which are all real things that we need to deal with. But, you know, it's almost too contemporary to actually, as a society, step back and really deconstruct and examine. But I don't know. I mean, I didn't show it to me, so I don't know. It gets a preemptive suck.
It sucks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about War Machine, the weekly box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring Beauty and the Beast and Bambi. Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies for the final segment of the show. And one more movie review I want to do. And this is a little old. It's a couple weeks old. And that is War Machine. This Netflix original film focuses on a fictionalized account of a general trying to make a name for himself in the occupation of Afghanistan.
We are here to build, to protect, to support the civilian population. To that end, we must avoid killing it at all costs. We can't help them and kill them at the same time. It just ain't humanly possible.
This war's been running 8 years now. Our hope is that you're the man who will get the job done.
It's a lost cause.
We can stay in Afghanistan forever.
That's why I'm gonna win it.
This made a lot of news because it was a Brad Pitt movie that came out on Netflix. Because, you know, when they were having Adam Sandler do it, that's his career in this slump. So it wasn't exactly like he was box office gold at that point. This was that original movie made for the Netflix service. And then it came out and I heard nothing. And I'm like, that's not a good sign. When all the reviews of War Machine died, right as it came out that Friday, I was like, this may not be good for the movie. And so, but I said, I'm going to watch it anyways, because I want to see what they've done. I mean, it's neat. It's kind of a coup to get Brad Pitt to do an original movie for Netflix. You wouldn't get Brad Pitt doing a TV movie in the 80s. It's got a good cast. It's actually got a great cast. And the acting for some people is really quite good. The acting by like Anthony Michael Hall's good in it. Scoot McNairy's in it. Topher Grace isn't too annoying in it. You have a really interesting performance by Tilda Swinton in this very small, almost cameo role. Meg Tilly as Brad Pitt's wife, which is great to see actually contemporarily born actors. I think they're 3 years apart in age. But Brad Pitt, it's supposed to be a big starring role for him, but I couldn't buy his performance. He comes across as a caricature, not as a character. And maybe it's just that it's so different, but he's almost kind of like this, and he almost talks like a cartoon. You know, you feel like he's like Yosemite Sam. And contrast that to, say, the character of, and I forget the character's name, but it was in Dr. Strangelove, the army general who took over the planes and the one sitting in the office talking about precious bodily fluids and peace on earth and how he's the one who Peter Sellers' character is trying to get the information from. That guy was bonkers, but he was very real. And you felt like there was an authentic character behind him. He didn't even feel like he was realistic enough to be put in a MASH episode. And I think that was just so distracting for me. The other problem is the writing's all over the place. It reminds me a little bit of Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, that movie with Tina Fey. That one just felt haphazard. It had a couple points to make, but, you know, and maybe that was the point, is to say, look how meandering and unfocused the war in Afghanistan was. And that's what this movie's trying to represent. I don't know if that's what it's doing, but if you want to interpret it that way, I guess that does work. But there are some decent moments in it, but it just, I was like halfway through the movie and my wife comes in the room and she asks what the movie's about. And I go, I really don't even know what it's about. I mean, I know what it's about, but I really don't know what its purpose is. And it's meant to be a satire, but it doesn't go far enough to be a satire. It's not absurd enough to be a satire. And it's almost like they made the movie and realized that if they just edited some different music in, they could take what was supposed to be dramatic and make it satire. And that doesn't make a good satire. So ultimately, War Machine kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. The winners this week, of course, the big winner last week at the box office was Wonder Woman. That was the one everybody was talking about. Did extremely well. And I'm going to say it broke a record. It didn't break records. People are like, record-breaking Wonder Woman. It broke a record for female directors' weekend box office take. It's higher than any movie ever directed by a woman. The one previous to that, I believe, was 50 Shades of Grey, which was like 80-some million. And this one cracked 100 million. And then that's great. You know, Patty Jenkins, good job. But Michelle Wolf from The Daily Show had a really neat little bit, and she made a great point. She said, when a woman can make a crappy superhero movie and then turn around and make another crappy superhero movie, that's when you know there's going to be a certain amount of equity in the movie world. And she's absolutely right. I mean, it's great that Patty Jenkins did this, but if Patty Jenkins does Wonder Woman 2 and it doesn't do as well, which it may not, you never know. Then suddenly people are going, oh, women directors don't know what they're doing. And you're going to have that misogynistic view from the studios. I think most people who went and saw this didn't care. They didn't know who directed. Most people don't know who directs movies unless it's like Steven Spielberg. Nobody cared. Nobody knows who Patty Jenkins is in the mainstream. And even now, nobody's going to say Patty Jenkins. Who's that? Oh, this woman who directed Wonder Woman. Oh, you mean the one about Wonder Woman? That name I know. So, you know, it's great that Wonder Woman made that much money, and good for it. It made 20 million more than I said it was going to make at 85. Captain Underpants underperformed a little bit, and that's too bad, but it still did fine for, I think, what it needed to be. This week, I think Wonder Woman's going to top again. I think The Mummy's going to struggle to get 40 million. I think Wonder Woman's good for 50. The word of mouth, the good reviews, all that stuff kind of coming together is going to help that movie. The Mummy, I think it might steal some of the IMAX screens, but I don't think it's going to get the audience that Wonder Woman had. So or even will just this weekend, I think. You know, even half of what they made last weekend for Wonder Woman, I think, is a good number for this week. So I think Wonder Woman's going to top again. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Spotlight this week is on Beauty and the Beast. The 1991 animated Disney classic gets a live-action treatment starring Emma Watson as a woman held captive by an enchanted beast in a castle.
I will escape.
Look, a girl.
Who said that?
Hello.
You can talk.
Hello, court. It's all he ever does.
How lovely to make your acquaintance.
What happens when the last petal falls?
The Mastel remains a beast forever.
And we become antiques. What did you do to it?
Nothing.
Get out of here! Go!
My family sat down and watched the original 1991 animated classic. And it's the first time I saw that it's been years. But obviously it's the first time I've seen it since I saw Beauty and the Beast in theaters. And I still have to say, I like that one better. It's so hard to top. And that's no flies on Bill Condon or Emma Watson or anybody else involved in Beauty and the Beast. It's just, the original is so good, and it's a hard act to follow. And I know it made $500 million in America, and that's great. Good for you, Disney. You know how to do your stuff. I mean, if I had to choose, I'm going to watch the animated film over and over again. But I mean, this is still a very lavish, beautiful production. If there's anything that Disney does, Disney knows how to give people what they want. And this was exactly what people wanted. And the Blu-ray, I mean, it looks gorgeous. It's a very beautiful looking movie. It's, for like I said, lavish is the word I'd use to describe it. And it's not like really packed with features. Your standard stuff, deleted scenes and, you know, like music videos and making of music videos. It has a neat little retrospective. It's like a 3-minute bit with Celine Dion, who originally did the first song in the first movie, Beauty and the Beast. And now she's doing a different song. And there's a spotlight on all the women involved in Beauty and the Beast, because there were a lot of women involved in productions and heads of departments, which is great and progressive for Disney. And that's wonderful. It's sort of like in the week of Wonder Woman's fame, you've got another movie that's really kind of highlighting the work of women in movies. and there's a behind the scenes. They have a table read of the movie. Like you said, it's not like loaded with special features, but obviously the movie made $500 million. So there's going to be a lot of fans for it. Now, the other one that came out this week that I like even more, and I want to spotlight that. And that is Bambi, the original Bambi, you know, back from the 40s. And this is such a sweet movie. And really, when you look at it, it's very different than the movies that you get now from Disney. I mean, this is 70 minutes long, and it was a real attempt to recreate nature in animation, especially with bringing in live animals in the animation studio. They didn't want them looking like sacks of flour, which they kind of looked like in Snow White when he had all the woodland creatures. So, I mean, just Bambi itself is a beautiful movie, and it's great to see it on a higher format, because I remember when the DVD came out many years ago, it looked great then, but now you've got, you know, an even better presentation of it. The bonus features, it's got all the old bonus features, so if you have the old disc, all the classic bonus features, like old deleted scenes and a deleted song and the making of it, you got the old mill animated short film, which uses the multi-layered perspective animation. So you've got some neat stuff in the classic bonuses. The new stuff includes kid stuff like facts about deer, and it has the thing called a Bambi effect, and it's got an Oswald the Lucky Rabbit cartoon. But the one that's just sort of like the real charm that you always get with these old Disney releases are the studio stories, where they take interviews from Walt Disney himself from the 50s and sort of edit it together in the short little bit about his thoughts on making the movie. Back in the DVD days, they actually had that as one of the commentary tracks. I don't find that in the Blu-ray, but you do get his take on Bambi. And that's it. I need to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Cars 3, Rough Night, 47 Meters Down, and All Eyes on Me. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.